This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Tom Geiger, Communications and Outreach Director for the Washington Environmental Council. Last November, Tom was here to tell us about the environmental community's priorities for legislation in the 2008 Washington State Legislative Session. He now returns to report on how those priorities fared during the 2008 session, which ended on March 13th. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks for having me back, Diane.
Could you briefly remind us of the environmental community's four priorities for the 2008 Washington State Legislative Session and why they are important?
Yes, there are four environmental community priorities, so-called priorities for Healthy Washington, that 22 groups in the state come up with during the summertime and then put to the state legislature each session. And the four that we have this year, two of them are climate-related, dealing with the issues of global warming. One is called Climate Action Green Jobs, and the other one was Local Solutions to Global Warming. And then the other two, in a way, are quite different, although in some ways they do have a climate connection. One is called Local Farms, Healthy Kids, connecting farmers with getting more locally grown food into schools primarily. And then the other one is Evergreen Cities, working to protect trees in urban areas and restore trees that have been lost and cut down.
Before we go into more detail, would you give us an overview of how the priorities fared in the session, and do you consider the session a successful one?
I think we fared very well. It was a short legislative session, as they call it. It's only 60 days long. Many of your listeners are probably aware that there's a sense that the economic forecast that generates the revenue for the state is decreasing, so the ability to get money out of the state to fund some of these programs is definitely a challenge. So considering those two dynamics, especially in the cautious nature of the legislature and the governor during an election year, we were fairly ambitious with putting these four to the legislators and having 60 days to move them. We made progress on all four. All four of them passed the legislature in different forms, some of which we were more happy about than others. On two cases, I think that they were what we would call a big win. On the Climate Action Green Jobs proposal, that was just a major step forward for the state of Washington and for the Western United States and even Western North America, because there's a lot of efforts going on now regionally and to really see how we as a region can move forward on global climate change, especially given the lack of federal action and the Bush administration's defiance of global warming. So that was a big win. We can talk about that more. And then on the Local Farms, Healthy Kids, it was quite a victory as well. A very broad coalition: farmers, environmentalists, nurses, teachers, public health officials, children's advocates, a wide variety of, in fact, about 70 organizations around the state joining together on that one. Washington Environmental Council playing a leading role on that one, as well as on climate action and green jobs. That was one of the rare occasions where I think the bill might have actually been improved during the legislative process, which is rare indeed. Usually it is weakened and gummed up quite a bit. The other two were modest gains: Local Solutions to Global Warming, dealing with the Growth Management Act and making reforms there to incorporate growth and climate together. Not as strong of a win there. We had to kind of parse it back a little bit. And the same with the Evergreen Cities, bring that back from some required action to voluntary action.
Now let's go into more detail about each of the priorities for a Healthy Washington. First, the Climate Action and Green Jobs Bill. What did the proponents of this bill hope to accomplish?
Well, even who the proponents of the bill were is an interesting question. This was a so-called governor request legislation. Certainly, the environmental community was very much in favor of it. It was a proposal that we came up with in concert with working with a bunch of different partners. For the past year, there had been a discussion around what was called the Climate Advisory Team coming out of legislation from a year ago, which we were very happy to pass, which in that case set up goals for the state to reduce its global warming pollution over time. The essential drive in this year's legislation was to put those goals into law, to make it not a goal but a strict limit that will be met and will be able to be enforced, will be able to be reported, known where the different sources are coming from, and hold those sources accountable to reduce that pollution over time instead of just a goal that maybe we'll meet it, maybe we won't. So we were able to get a lot of that support lined up. And indeed, on the first day of the session, the governor held a big press conference with the environmental community, with the business community, with labor and others, lining up in support of her so-called request legislation. And it was a bumpy road during session, a lot of curves and ups and downs and a few close calls to the legislation actually being completely derailed. And credit goes to the governor for her engagement in that, especially in a few key times actually walking over to the legislature itself and not twisting arms, but certainly being present and making her voice known to move that legislation forward. What it does, essentially, it puts a real cap or a limit on the pollution that contributes to global warming from Washington State, and then will reduce that over time over the next couple of decades. So that really being the key to meeting the global challenge of climate change. It isn't just about stopping the increase in pollution. It's about reducing the pollution that we currently make. One of the key causes of global warming pollution from Washington State is transportation. About half of our global warming pollution comes from cars. So we were able to get in an effort here to work to begin to address so-called vehicle miles traveled, how many miles are cars and trucks driving in the state of Washington, and working to reduce that. Quite a challenge, given that we're going to be increasing in population. The trend is for more and more people to own more and more cars and drive more and more each person. And what we're talking about here is reducing the overall miles traveled over time in the state. A real cultural shift, if you will, driving less, but maybe getting around just as much. We need to move goods. We need to move people. So that'll be quite a challenge. The other great thing about that effort is the green jobs part. We think that real environmental protection and sustainable economic growth go hand in hand. And at the Washington Environmental Council, we've been working on that for decades, literally. This legislation links those two concepts in title and in statute so that we can move forward with reducing our pollution and at the same time increasing employment, increasing jobs, not just for Washington State, but as the global warming reduction economy, if you will, the clean energy economy moves globally, we can be an expander and an exporter of jobs and skills and technology that we've created here first.
What's specifically being proposed to create the green jobs?
Well, we didn't get as much as we would have wanted on that front, but what we're going to be doing with this legislation in the immediate term, and there was funding provided for it, is to do the analysis within the state's economy, where are the opportunities for employment, let's say in wind technology or in efficiency renovation in buildings or in lighting production or whatever it may be. Where are those opportunities? Where is the available market as far as people that are already employed or trained in those areas? And then where's the gap? And the expectation is there are going to be very large gaps, tens of thousands of jobs needed to fill those opportunities. And then by identifying those, the state can invest some money, the private sector can invest some money to train up a workforce and be able to do those jobs going into the future.
Could you comment also on the reporting requirements that are in the bill?
Certainly. One of the strange things, if you will, there's a sense that issues like water pollution and air pollution, traditional air pollution concepts, have been reported from industries for decades now, since the early 1970s. A lot of global warming pollution isn't known in that same way, CO2 emissions in particular. So what we're requiring here is for companies in particular that are making a large contribution to pollution in the state, that they report that to the Department of Ecology so that we can start to have, if you will, a baseline of information. And when you say we're going to cap our pollution and then reduce it over time, you're going to cap it from where and reduce it from where? So we need to know in 2008, what is the global warming pollution coming out of our tailpipes, out of our smokestacks in the state of Washington? And this bill will accomplish that. The Department of Transportation will also work to be able to, if you will, kind of assess how many cars there are in the state and make a rough approximate calculation of how much pollution is coming from that source, it being a major one, so that we can start to reduce that as well.
Which aspects of the bill were the most controversial and difficult to get through?
I think the whole concept of the Department of Ecology working with the governor's office and moving forward in a regional system on a so-called cap and trade system. So not just Washington State, but other states throughout the western United States and the western Canadian provinces, except for Alberta. How do they work together? So there's a Western Climate Initiative, a process that the governor is taking a leadership role in, that is going to be working over the next year, between now and next fall, to figure out what sort of regional cap there could be. And then also, once we establish that cap, how can we use economic forces to allow for people that are producing less carbon dioxide pollution, or indeed maybe even sequestering or storing carbon through their business practices, how can they get a credit, if you will, a social credit for that good behavior? And when people are polluting too much, requiring them to, if you will, buy some of those credits. It's a tricky system. It hasn't been worked out completely well. The Economic Union in Europe has tried it with a few fits and starts, but it's certainly a direction I think the global market is going to take things. We want to set it up correctly. As a result of all those kind of question marks, I think there was a lot of tension around moving that forward from different forces, people that support reforming global warming and people that oppose it. That said, I don't think that there was a lot of opposition to the concept of global warming anymore. There were a few legislators who spoke out against the idea that global warming exists, but they are very much in the marginalized minority at this point. It's a big shift in the last 5 years.
I'm Diane Horn, and we were speaking with Tom Geiger, Communications and Outreach Director for the Washington Environmental Council. Our topic is environmental legislation passed in the 2008 Washington State Legislative Session. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Let's go on now to the Local Solutions to Global Warming bill. What did the proponents of this bill hope to accomplish?
This legislation looks at, again, that issue of where does our global warming pollution come from? A lot of our global warming pollution, again, over half, comes from automobile cars and trucks primarily. One of the challenges there is, why do we drive so much? And a lot of that comes from how our communities are laid out. People tend to live in a different place from where they work, and then they drop their kid off to school, a lot of them now driving their children to school. And then they have to swing by the store on the way home, and the store is in a different town. So there's just driving, driving, driving. There's not really a sense when we're laying out our communities historically about what the global warming pollution impacts would be from laying out a community one way versus another. That's really the idea behind this legislation is within the Growth Management Act, we already start to look at what are the impacts on water, what are the impacts on wildlife, what are the impacts on farmland. We are not required under current law to look at what are the impacts of that kind of growth on global warming pollution. So that was the big new step here, is to incorporate that into the Growth Management Act. It wasn't accomplished as far as what we had hoped to get done, but it is important to recognize that the Growth Management Act is actually a somewhat controversial act, especially down in the legislature. There have been many more attempts to weaken it over the years than strengthen it, it being now, I guess, around for about 17 years. And this was really the first year where we were able to pass legislation through the state legislature, the House and the Senate, with some pretty strong votes that actually improves the Growth Management Act. The fact that currently the governor is under pressure to maybe veto that legislation is an interesting dynamic, given that there was a Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate that helped bring about that first in several decades advance of statute. We'll see how that plays out. It's going to play out in the next couple weeks for sure. And if people have an opinion upon that, they could go to our website if they want to and get the governor's phone number and call her up. The main thing that we were doing there, again, is trying to establish that way in which you would reduce global warming pollution through growth management practices. How do you do that? Well, part of the reality is we don't really know. So what the legislation will do, the way that it was passed, is create tools by the state government, the Community Trade and Economic Development Agency, that then local governments now will voluntarily be able to employ if they wanted to. There's about 25 cities across the state of Washington that have adopted, with Greg Nickels, Mayor Nickels' support, the Kyoto Protocols, the global warming challenge they've taken. So they've made a commitment at the local city level to reduce their global warming pollution. A lot of those cities didn't know how they were going to do that. So the great thing about this legislation, the state will be creating these tools, the local governments will then be able to employ them and meet their global warming pollution goals.
And what is the basis of wanting the legislation to be vetoed?
Well, I don't think there really is a basis. I mean, I think it's more of a cultural or rhetorical opposition. The Association of Washington Businesses and others sometimes are just opposed to legislation that, in this case, would strengthen a law that in many cases they don't agree with. I think that's where the opposition really comes from, as opposed to some real fundamental and legitimate complaint about what this does, because it really doesn't require anything. It requires that a state agency come up with some tools that could be voluntarily employed by some local governments. I don't think it's reasonable to be opposed to that. I think that's shown by the fact that it passed by such a strong margin, and I certainly hope that the governor defies that opposition and signs it into law.
You said that you had hoped for a stronger bill initially. If the bill had gone through as you had wanted it to, what would it have looked like?
Well, the two things that would have been different, there would have been an amendment to the actual law itself. The desire to have local communities incorporate these tools into their local planning instead of being voluntary would be required. There would still be a lot of flexibility in that under the way that we proposed it. That local communities are required to come up with what's called a comprehensive plan, a way to look at the way they're going to grow in the future, dealing with growth in population, school needs, transportation, parks. And what this would have done is said, the next time you engage that process, so you don't have to do it right away, and the next time would have started in 2011, so a few years out, the next time you engage that process, you will need to incorporate an additional planning method into your local work, and that's to deal with global warming. That's not going to be required now. That said, the tool is still going to be developed, and those governments that want to engage that process will be able to do it. So that's really the most significant change between what we initially proposed and what was passed.
So that it became voluntary rather than mandatory.
Exactly.
Moving on, what was the goal of the Evergreen Communities Act?
Yeah, the Evergreen Communities or Evergreen Cities Act really is trying to look at the fact that in many urban areas around the state, we have lost our trees, despite the fact that we're known as the evergreen state around the world. And maybe we're evergreen more because of our lawns now, I guess. But the tree canopy or the forest, the urban forests as they're called, provide an incredible asset to our communities. Not just are they attractive, and you know that by when you drive around and look at wealthier communities within a city, there still tend to be trees in those areas. In the lower income areas, maybe not so many trees. As population growth has happened, and because there are typically very few, if any, restrictions on the amount of tree cutting that you can do in an area, developers would tend to come in and just cut down all the trees, start from a clean landscape, if you will. It's cheaper and easier sometimes to do that when you're doing development. As a result of that, we've got significant problems with stormwater, significant problems with water pollution and flooding, all sorts of things that we could prevent if we had kept those trees. So the first thing that you need to do when you're in a hole is stop digging. And as a result, we want to basically restrict the amount of cutting that can happen in urban areas around the state and then have local communities develop plans to restore those trees. The way this one turned out, again, was less restrictive and less requiring than we had initially envisioned it. It doesn't require that local communities do anything. It sets up some programs working with the State Department of Natural Resources and others to develop some tools and methods at the state level that could be then, again, employed at the local level. If a local community is trying to put in a tree ordinance, for instance, they don't have to recreate the wheel each time. There could be a statewide kind of template of an ordinance that could be used and employed locally.
Moving on, what are the key elements of the Local Farms Healthy Kids Bill that passed in the session?
It was so exciting for me. I worked a lot on this myself, and Washington Environmental Council played a leading role in this. It was one of those rare occasions where you have a coalition that is so broad. I mean, there were, in our weekly phone calls and emails when we were working on the campaign, there were like 100 organizations and people around the state involved in this. A very broad, real, diverse coalition. And the reason why I think it worked is because it connects to so many people's lives. The basic point of this legislation is to increase the amount of locally grown food being eaten by kids. And the best and easiest way to do that is to get that locally grown food into schools. There are 1 million children that go to school every Monday through Friday in the state of Washington, K through 12. That's a lot of kids eating a lot of food. What is the food that they're eating right now? I think most of us would agree that we could have more nutritious and fresh food being consumed in our schools. Unfortunately, there's actually a law that, well, up until now, because the governor is signing this law, this bill is passed by the legislature, But there's been a restriction on that purchasing. Local community schools have been required to basically buy the cheapest food available. And often the cheapest food is not the freshest food, and it's not the locally grown food. So this removes that requirement. Again, it does not require any school or local community to buy this locally grown food. It just removes that obstacle from the law. And in certain cases, where we were able to get about $500,000 in state funding, it provides money to poorer schools, schools where about half of the kids or more are on reduced or free school lunch program. It provides them money so that they have some extra financial support to move forward with those purchases. And then finally, the reason why it was such a broad support is the local distributors, local food processors, potential local storage facilities, local farmers, all these different parts of the economy have something to gain from this law, because it is about reconnecting and rebuilding a local farming economy that largely has been lost in the state of Washington. So you're going to be keeping farmland, you're going to be building up local economic development, and you're going to be protecting the environment and improving kids' health. Who can be against that? Apparently no one. There was only one legislator who voted against this during the entire legislative process, essentially a unanimous vote for this. And again, the governor is signing this into law.
I'm Diane Horn, and we were speaking with Tom Geiger, Communications and Outreach Director for the Washington Environmental Council. Our topic is environmental legislation passed in the 2008 Washington State Legislative Session. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How solid is the funding for the four environmental priorities that passed the legislature?
I mean, the funding is solid in the sense that the budget's being approved. I think we ended up getting about half of the money that we initially proposed. It was a fairly modest proposal, we felt, from the get-go. We recognized the financial constraints that the legislature was under. We went for just about $10 million and I think came just under $5 million, all said and done, between all four of the bills. Again, it was a short session. It's a non-budget session, meaning it's typically very small budget items. So I think that everything considered, we did fairly well. As we move forward as a state, looking into the 2009 and 2010 years, how the economy goes generally will affect the state budget. Our state budget revenue largely comes from sales tax. It's a very regressive system. It affects poor people a lot more. They pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes when it's a sales tax. A rich person buying a hamburger pays the same tax on that hamburger as a person who makes $10,000 a year working at McDonald's. So when the economy slows down, sales tax revenues slow down because people buy fewer things. So that's going to be a real challenge, not just for environmental protection, but all the other things that depend on funding in the state.
In addition to your key priorities, were there other environmental bills of note that passed in the 2008 session?
Yes, is the short answer. The environmental community priorities of these four bills is really an attempt, and I think a successful one, to focus some time and energy. It's not to exclude, nor has it excluded other bills moving. There was a great advance made with a toxic-free toy bill that was passed by the legislature, and there's been tremendous pressure with the CEOs of Hasbro and Mattel, major international toy companies, flying into the state, putting pressure on the governor to actually veto that legislation. We would strongly disagree with that and have made that clear to the governor. Hundreds of people have called the governor asking for her to not veto that, to pass it as it was passed by the legislature. And again, people could go to our website, wecprotects.org, to get some information to call the governor on that. Two really positive ones that passed as well. There have been efforts for years to get a permanent tug based out on the end of the Straits of Juan de Fuca to be able to help vessels that lose power coming through the straits and prevent a massive oil spill in the inner Puget Sound. We were able to pass legislation in this tight budget year to get a permanent tug for the first time ever placed out on the end of the straits. And then finally, there was some very strong efforts passed on tolling and moving forward with some 520 reconstruction that I think bode well for some transportation choices in the future.
Your strategy of having the environmental community in Washington State come together and choose a limited number of priorities seems to have been quite successful. Is the same strategy being used in other states?
It is now. My director has gone and made presentation at national conferences. I've gotten calls from many other states asking if they could even use our name, if they could be priorities for Healthy Oregon or something like that. success breeds success. So people pay attention when you're able to win, when you're able to organize. And definitely the method there is trying to be employed in other places. Like most of things in life, it's not as simple as, oh, just do four priorities and then you'll just come out the other end with four bills that have passed. There's a lot of factors that have gone into the success of this, the strategy of choosing four being one of them, the community being disciplined to stick to just four. When we passed all four last year, there was definitely discussion and pressure. Well, hey, why not ask for five? Why not ask for six or seven? Well, there's a reason for that. Discipline is an important element of success, just like in, you know, personal budgeting or anything. The other thing is being able to correctly assess where you can go with politics. And you don't want to only ask for what is seen as achievable. You want to push the envelope a little bit, but you don't want to push it so far that you break the back. And so far, I think we've done a pretty good job kind of making those judgment calls as we go along.
What's likely to be on the agenda for the 2009 Washington State legislative session?
We just had a meeting this week, actually, about a three-hour meeting to discuss this very point. There's no rest for the weary here. And the next legislative session will be a long one, as they call it, a 120-day session. It will happen after the governor's race next fall in November. You know, so you don't actually know the way the politics are going to shake down for next year. Washington Environmental Council certainly is going to be leading the community and working with them to come up with four priorities that we think make a lot of sense. I think the issues of Puget Sound protection and global warming are very likely to be in that mix. There may be an attempt to combine some issues together next year. Things really are connected, so some of the challenges faced by water supply are connected to climate change and the snowpack being melted in Washington State's glaciers. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that shakes down. Washington Environmental Council, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. Been down in the state legislature for 40 years in a row, done a lot of good work, but we really see where we're going to be a very positive story as a state and as a nation, if the nation can take the lead from where we've been pushing WEC. We have a big event in the fall to celebrate that 40th anniversary, and it's right after the fall elections. So we'll see if we're celebrating or not. I'm not sure how the elections come out will end up impacting how environmental protection is able to move forward.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess be involved. Your legislators are only as accountable as you make them, and your governor is only as accountable as you make her. So you can always come to our website. Washington Environmental Council's website is www.wecprotects.org, and get information about how to be involved, whether it's being a volunteer, whether it's calling your legislator or writing a letter to your local paper. You know, freedom is not something that you have. It's something that you use. And if you don't use it, you will lose it. And so we definitely encourage all your listeners to be involved.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Tom.
Thanks.
We have just been speaking with Tom Geiger, Communications and Outreach Director for the Washington Environmental Council. For more information about the 2008 Priorities for a Healthy Washington, check on the web at www.environmentalpriorities.org. Again, that's environmentalpriorities.org. And to contact the Washington Environmental Council, call area code 206-631-2600. Again, that's 206-631-2600. Or visit their website at www.wecprotects.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.